Welcome to this week's Khaki Malarkey. We've got the last one of the season for you today, where we are joined by the wonderful Sharon Connolly. Sharon's held a passion for history for over 30 years and has had a career ranging from studying at Northampton University, being a tour guide of historical sites, being a blog writer. She's even appeared on BBC Radio and Australian Television's Who Do You Think You Are? Sharon is here today to talk to us about her book, The Ladies of the Magna Carta.
Well, Sharon, I can reassure you, it's not going to take a good 2 odd hours to do this today. I'm about just under an hour, depending how we go, not even that. So,
dear little Faith, do you know how much I like talking history?
Oh, brilliant. This is the right place for it. You are, yeah. I hope we've all got a cup of tea or drink ready, because I think it's going to be a great one. We're very excited for this topic. Well, Sharon, I need my watch for this one. Oh, yeah. We ask all of our guests this question, if they can summarise their book in 30 seconds. Are you ready for the challenge?
I'm still not sure. I didn't actually practice my book in 30 seconds. Yeah, we'll give it a go.
Over it.
All right. Well, it's about the women who were influenced by or used Magna Carta to improve their lives and the lives of others. It tells the stories of those who are actually in the Magna Carta. There's only two women actually mentioned in Magna Carta. The ones who fought during the First Barons' War and the ones who used Magna Carta later to actually defend their own rights. There you go.
I think I was just bang on 29 seconds.
Wow, yes. We get two types of guests on here. We get the ones that try and squeeze it into about 10 seconds. And they're like, I'm just going to shout everything out. And the ones that go proper, like, bang on 30 seconds. So
brilliant.
Well done.
So well my done. Mind goes blank and thinks, what was the blurb again? I can't remember.
I get that. You did. Oh, I think you did brilliant. So thank you. Just to give us a bit of context then, please, Sharon, you know, to the signing of the Magna Carta, what was going on briefly just kind of before in the run up to it?
That's another hard question.
I'm
one of these people who, you know how everybody says King John, bad guy, hate him. I actually love researching King John. I think because he was a bad guy and he was just so interesting. So the build-up to Magna Carta was King John having a quarrel with his barons. And Magna Carta was sealed, not signed. Which is always, you see on the 20th of June, everybody says the sealing of Magna Carta, and then shows this picture of John with a pen in his hand. Sealed, not signed. And it was basically a peace treaty between John and his barons to try and prevent civil war. Yeah. The problem was, straight after the sealing of Magna Carta, John wrote to the Pope and said, my barons have made me do this and I didn't want to. So the Pope turned around and said, okay, you don't have to stand by it. And it caused the Civil War, the First Barons' War in 1215. And basically John, William Marshall, and a couple of others were on one side, and on the other side were the barons. There were about 15 leading barons who decided that they wanted to go to war with John to stop him being as nasty as he was. And they even invited the French prince over to take the throne rather than John. So Prince Louis, the son of Philip II, who was John's former ally, but then his enemy, then his ally, then his enemy, came over to try and steal the throne. They had a funny relationship, Philip and John. And so that was the background to it. John had lost the English possessions in France, which didn't help much either, because they were called Anglo-Norman barons, because most of the English barons at the time were also Normans. So they had half their property in England and half their property in France. So when John lost their property as well, and they weren't very happy about it.
Oh my God, I bet.
And suddenly John only had England to get his revenues from. So he was taxing the barons, and they didn't like that. Yeah. And then he went after one particular baron, William de Brayot, because his wife had said something she shouldn't have.
What did she say?
Yeah. Well, she actually told John's representatives that John had asked for two of her sons as hostages to guarantee her husband's good faith. And she turned around and said, I'm not doing that because John killed his own nephew, and I'm not having that happen to my sons.
Oh,
so
fair enough.
John didn't like the idea that she knew that he'd killed Arthur. Yeah. But nobody was supposed to know. It's just her husband was with John at the time. So John chased her to Ireland and back, imprisoned her, and in either Corfe or Windsor, nobody can work out which castle particularly, but he put her and her son in prison. Her husband promised he'd get the money that he owed John and then ran away to France, dressed as a beggar. And poor Maud and her son were in this prison cell and John basically forgot to feed them. So after, after nearly 2 weeks, somebody opens the door and finds poor Maud leaning against her son, bite marks on his cheek where she tried to survive that little bit longer. That's my background in Magna Carta. That was the story that got me really interested in the Magna Carta story. One of the clauses that is still in use today, that no man shall be imprisoned or fined without peer review, without a jury. Yeah. And that is based on the fact that poor Maud de Brayose was imprisoned without trial and died in the prison because John forgot to feed her. Yeah. He had the habit of doing that with his prisoners, to be fair. He did it a few times. He forgot to feed his prisoners.
Oh, that's what an awful man.
But fascinating!
It really is.
What is sometimes the most...
There's nothing to research.
The most interesting characters to research are the complex ones, aren't they? I mean, it often gets brought up about, I'm thinking of like Winston Churchill in a modern context. So it's like, good guy, bad guy, both sides. What are you going to go for today? Which side are you going to see? So it is, do you think there's a lot of like misconceptions around the sealing of the Magna Carta?
The thing is, at the time, Magna Carta was just a peace treaty. It's a way for the barons to get John to behave the way he wanted them to, way they wanted him to. Over the years, it's become, because we don't have a constitution in this country, it's become our unofficial constitution. And the fact that other countries have used the basis of Magna Carta for their own constitutions, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is based on Magna Carta, the American Declaration of Independence is based on Magna Carta. It's like, it is now our unofficial constitution, but at the time it was just the barons trying to control John and it didn't go across very well. But since then, I mean, it was issued in 1215, but then it was reissued after John died, reissued in 1225. Even Simon de Montfort used it in 1265, and then it was forgotten about until the English Civil Wars in the 1600s. So it's had a long life. At first, it wasn't what it is now, sort of thing. It
really, like, snowballed into significance over history.
Yeah, exactly.
So there must be a lot of people that didn't even know that there were women involved in the Magna Carta. So can you give us, I mean, a little introduction into the ladies of the Magna Carta? How exactly were women involved?
Well, like I said, there was Maud de Brayose, who influenced clauses 39 and 40. There are only 8 mentions of women in the whole charter. There's 60 clauses, but there's only 8 mentions of women. And there's only 2 women who can actually be identified, except for the Queen. She's mentioned as well. But 2 women are in clause 51, there's 2 princesses of Scotland who are identified because they'd been hostages since 1209. So for 6 years, they'd been in John's custody. He'd promised to marry them off to either his sons or some leading nobles, and he never got round to it. So the Scottish insisted on it being in the Magna Carta that they would be either married or sent back home. So those are Margaret and Isabella of Scotland, and they're the only 2 women in it. But there's other instances in Magna Carta, like there's clause 8, I think it is, where they're protecting the inheritances. And that's the main thing with women in Magna Carta, is to protect the inheritance if it goes through a woman, so that unruly men, guardians, can't sell off their land without permission, and girls can't be forced. Wards, minors, children, people under the age of 21 who are still in wardship and have a guardian, can't be forced to marry below their status. So, because that was a big thing as well, you know, you can't make a princess marry a lord just because he's rich. It's not, she's entitled to marry a prince, sort of thing, or a lady is entitled to marry a lord rather than a peasant. So they can't just be married off for money if it's against their status, if it disparages their status, sort of thing. So that's what Magna Carta does with the women. But there's also women have used Magna Carta themselves. Mm. And there were women fighting during the Barons' War that followed Magna Carta, which is, I know you've read the book, haven't you? So you've read about Nicola de la Haye. She's my favourite person of all time. She's brilliant. She defended Lincoln Castle in three sieges. And the last one being the 1217 siege, which lasted for about 6 weeks and ended with the Battle of Lincoln. So Nicola was in her 60s and you had William Marshall, the greatest knight. And, you know, he was the regent at the time for Henry III, coming to her rescue, saying it would be ignoble not to rescue so great a lady. And yeah. But you've got Nicola, she's in her 60s, and William Marshall in his 70s coming to her rescue. And I just think it would make a great film if they were each about 30 or 40 years younger.
I think it would make a great film. You know, having that kind of older protagonist is not something we really see. And it's so interesting, especially you thinking, what, in the 1200s, that a woman of her 60s is doing that. I think that's remarkable.
Yeah, I think she was incredible. She's an amazing woman.
That's so cool.
So a key element of your book is relationships. And did the Magna Carta affect relationships or strengthen them, especially amongst women?
It wasn't meant to be a key element. It was supposed to be all these different women who were affected by Magna Carta and just talk about them. And it turned out that, oh, well, she's related to so-and-so. He's related to William Marshall. So they're on that. And everybody in the nobility at that time were related. You could find out, but it wasn't meant to be. That wasn't...
The English aristocracy, honestly.
Yeah, because you had... Take William Marshall's eldest daughter, Matilda. She was married to, let me get this right, either Hugh or Roger Bego, the Earl of Norfolk's son anyway, Hugh. Mm. And he was on the side of the barons, whereas William Marshall stayed loyal to the king. And so poor Matilda's in the middle of this. She's married to a rebel, but her dad's the king's greatest supporter. And then she has this son who's just a little boy. The king comes to Framlingham Castle to besiege it. Her son's in the castle. So he's only about 4 or 5 years old. The Earl of Norfolk does surrender the castle, so there's no fighting. But then her son's taken into John's custody. Oh. And it's like, so her husband's the rebel. Her little boy is suddenly in the custody of the royalists. Luckily, John dies, and then... Luckily. So the regent becomes the guardian of her son, and the regent happens to be her dad. Oh. So William Marshall. So suddenly her son's just got less worries because John's no longer got charge of her son, but his granddad has, so he's all right. But that's the kind of, you know, the family, they're all wondering about what family ties there are and that, and it's all linked together.
Oh, that's been very interesting researching. You definitely putting together your pieces of the puzzle, being like, oh my god, they fit here, they fit there.
Yeah, but that's why somebody says to me, why didn't you put a family tree in there? I was like, oh my god, I could put a family tree in there if I tried.
The next book.
There'll just be lots of lines in between everything, connecting all over the place.
You wouldn't see it.
So, can you give our listeners a couple of examples? I know we've mentioned some names already, but is there any particular women who were very influential, or even just women whose stories you'd like to highlight? Is there anything, anyone in particular you think, I want people to know about this?
Yeah, well, like I said, Matilda de Breos, then there was Nicola de la Haye. Yeah. There was Matilda's daughter as well, Loretta de Breos, who influenced the clauses about inheritance, because John tried to take her inheritance from her. Ooh. He even exiled her into Europe at one stage so that he could control her lands. So the one about not being allowed to sell off Ward's lands is basically about Loretta's lands and John trying to sell off all the little parts of her lands.
Why did he want to do that?
Because she was a Breos and he didn't like the Breoses by that time. So she was very interesting because she came back and she claimed her lands and she got them back. Then there's Isabel d'Aubigny, who was actually later on, she was in the reign of Henry III. She was the daughter of the 5th Earl of Warren, and she married Hugh Daubigny, the Earl of Arundel. And she was she'd been a widow from something like the age of 17. She was married for about 5 years, but she was widowed at about 17 or 18. And she was very protective of her lands. When one of her tenants died, King Henry took his son into wardship. And the problem was that the land that Henry took the wardship of was part of Isabel's land. So she actually wrote to Henry and said, you know, this is my land.
Yeah.
And you've taken it. And Henry was like, no. And she actually, in the end, she went to court and told Henry off. And said something like, where are the liberties of England, so often spoken, so often cited, and so often betrayed?
Oh, wow.
Fantastic.
I love the image of this woman just like busting down the doors of court and being like, oi.
Yeah, oi, give me my land back. When Henry writes about it, he writes back saying, yeah, we'll let her do this, but so long as she doesn't tell me off again.
Fantastic.
This formidable woman just telling the king off, and he's like, yeah, all right, yeah, just don't say that again.
Well, you know, sometimes you just need to get dressed down by a strong woman.
Exactly.
We won't give any more of your book away. Honestly, we need our listeners to buy it. Get out. Where can we get your book from, Sharon? Where can I find it?
Amazon, Pen and Sword, all good bookshops, hopefully. Not that you can go to a bookshop at the minute.
Independent bookshops.
Yeah, independent. There is an organisation called bookshop.co.uk, I think it is. And if you buy from them, they give a percentage to your local bookshop.
Oh, lovely.
So I've ordered some from them at Christmas, and they delivered quicker than Amazon did, to be honest. Amazon couldn't get the books I wanted, and they did. And they give a percentage to local bookshops, which is brilliant.
Oh, I really like that. Really do. Well, thank you for sharing that. Well, we kind of like to make our interviews a bit different, and I know that our listeners and also us, we love to know a bit about the authors, and we'd love to know, how did you get into history?
I've always been into history. I can't remember not being into history. I grew up in South Yorkshire, about two towns away from Conisbrough Castle, which is, when I was a kid, all that you knew about Conisbrough Castle was it was unique because it's a hexagon rather than a circle or a square or something. Cool. And Sir Walter Scott was driving by it when he thought of Ivanhoe. And Ivanhoe's dad's castle in the book is based on Conisbrough Castle. And that's all you knew about Conisbrough Castle growing up. Since then, I've learned more about the castle, and it was given to one of William the Conqueror's chief supporters after the conquest, William de Warenne. And he was made Earl of Surrey in 1086, and they owned it until 1347. So there were 7 earls who owned it. And then it went into the royal family, and the Dukes of York owned it. So Edward IV and Richard III both owned it. Wow. And when I was growing up, all we knew was Ivanhoe had something to do with it. And there's all these royal links. It was built, the actual castle that's there now, the keep, was built by Henry II's half-brother, Hamlin Plantagenet. So it's a great little castle, and I think that's where I got into history.
It sounds like a hidden gem. It's one of those places that you kind of said, there's not much on it, but there's so much history packed into such a...
Yeah, there is, and when you go there, they put... When I was a kid, it was a shell. There was no roof, no floors in it or anything, and there was this really narrow walkway round the walls when you went inside. You sort of, you know, took your life in your hands trying to get to the top of the keep. And it had this green slime down the walls because of acid rain. But English Heritage have taken it over, and they've put a roof on, and they've put floors in, and it's so much better now.
Oh, how wonderful.
It's so much easier to climb up. But yeah, it's a stunning little castle, but it's so out of the way. Few people have heard of it. There's a lot more now, and I'm trying my best to make sure that people know about it a bit more now as well. My next book is about the Warren Earls, so that's coming out.
Oh, fantastic.
So yeah, it gets a good few mentions in there.
Yeah, that's an exclusive, everyone.
So how did you get from your love of history to your career now? How did you get here to where you are?
I'm not exactly sure. believe it or not. I did history.
No, you just stumbled into it.
Sort of. I did history all through university. Then when I left university, I went to work for Euro Disney in France for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Because I didn't know what I wanted to do, and the jobs came up. They were taking, you know, summer work. So I went over to France for 6 months.
Oh, how lovely.
And then when I came back, I got a job at Eurostar because I'd worked for Euro Disney in customer services. The training at Disney was so good. Eurostar basically took you on if you'd worked at Disney
could
answer the, do the interview sort of thing. So I did Eurostar for 5 years, where I met my hubby. And then we moved up here. In the early 2000s, we moved back up north. He's a Londoner, but I'm a Yorkshire lass.
Well done.
So I'm trying to convert him.
Yeah, well done. You dragged him up.
But I've always constantly studied history. You know, every book, if you look at my book collection, there's very little there other than history. It's history this, history that. And then in 2014, he bought me a blog for Christmas because he didn't know where to get me. So he got me a blog. And I had been trying to write this book for ages, and I never actually got to writing it. I just kept researching it, called History, the Interesting Bits. And I still haven't written it, but we used that as the title of the blog. So then I start writing articles on the blog, and I saw an advert from Amberley Publishing and the Historical Writers Association were doing a competition for new authors to get their first non-fiction book published. And I spent the summer looking at this advert thinking, oh, maybe I will, maybe I won't. No, I won't. I don't want to, because they might say no, so I'm not sending anything in. And In the end, I wrote up, they wanted your author bio, a chapter plan, a synopsis of the book, and 2,000 word introduction. So I did all that, thinking, I'm still not sending it in. And about a week before the closing day, I decided, I think I must have turned away from the computer, you know, doing that and just pensing.
Oh, bless you.
I'm thinking, you've got nothing to lose, Sharon. Send it in.
Exactly. That's it, isn't it? Don't get.
Yeah, the closing date was the end of January and I heard nothing. So I thought, oh, stuff it. At least I've tried. But I might try and flesh it out a bit more and send it into some other places, because a friend of mine who's an author, Amy Lyson, said, Sharon, it's a good idea. So I was saying, all right, well, I might flesh it out and see what I can do. Yeah. And then in the March, I got an email from Amberley saying, oh, you remember that competition? Well, you didn't win.
Like, oh, thanks.
But the next line was, but we'd like to publish your book anyway.
Oh my God, that's brilliant.
Well, that's the best Dear John letter I've ever had.
Yeah.
And then he sank in and he's like, oh God, I've got to write it now.
That's always the thing, isn't it? When you submit something and you're like, oh, this is a great idea. I'll submit a little teaser. And then you actually have to write it and you think, oh shit, I've got to do that.
Every time.
Because with your first one as well, it's like, how long will it take you to write? I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, and you've done it. Well done.
Yeah, yeah. So that was Heroines of the Medieval World, and I was just so glad I'd done it. Sorry?
How many books have you published now?
I've published 3 so far, and there's another one coming out in May.
Woo! So excited. It's brilliant.
So in your, this is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek question for us, to be honest, but it's one that I love to ask. In your kind of history career, in the field at the moment, has there been anything that really bugs you, like a myth that you want to debunk, maybe like I said earlier about the misconceptions around the Magna Carta, or like a stereotype you get hit with, or something that people often say to you? Would there be anything that jumps to mind as in, oh God, that's what I'd change about the field if I could?
I think it would be the fact, the idea that women didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Because there were so many remarkable women. I mean, Heroines of the Medieval World, I think, I haven't actually counted how many women are in there, but I think there's about 65, something like that.
Oh, wow.
But it's just the idea that women weren't capable of doing anything except raise children.
Yeah.
And yes, some weren't capable of doing anything except raise children, but some of them, a lot of them, were really powerful. And even if it was just behind the scenes, you know, they didn't always do it in the limelight, but they did make a difference and they did help shape the world, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that would be the one for me, the because I was the same as everybody else. When I was in my teens, all I wanted to read about was the wars and the battles and that. Mm. I wasn't interested in women's history.
Yeah.
It was only when I got older that I started looking at biographies of women and realising that they weren't just these meek little women who had men walk over them. There are very few who were like that. They all had their own...
formidable, like we've discussed today, like it was very formidable women. And yeah, I think especially with a topic like, I'm sure Liv feels the same, with military history, it's often, women have always been sidelined to it.
The carer, the nurse,
Yeah, exactly. But they've
the traditional role.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, definitely. And yet, I mean, when you read, I was a big Bernard Cornwell fan in my teens and 20s. So when you read, I still am to be fair, but when you read the short books and they talk about the women there, they weren't these meek little women. The women who followed the soldiers were really strong women. You know, they'd walk, they'd join in a retreat in the snow.
Joining an army, are they? It's a hard work traveling with an army. It's not exactly that they were just sat there on the back of a cart looking pretty. Like,
yeah, no, they were walking with the soldiers. And there was one, the one that got me was this pregnant woman who just fell out of the march for a day to give birth and then joined back in with the baby.
Oh, as you do. Why not? And that's the strength of the woman. Yeah. I mean, incredible. No pain relief. No wheelchair.
Probably just had a glass of alcohol and that was it. Crack on.
Done. That's remarkable. It really is.
It is. And it's that kind of thing that I want to... And I do get, every now and then I get somebody saying, oh, no, women didn't do that. You're just making it up, or you're just, that is not what happened. And it's like, and it's always, it is invariably men.
Yeah. So are they historians? No. Are they looking into it? No.
Yeah. You're trying to overplay women's parts, I think, and they punch people. And then, like,
that's the thing. They're saying, what I'm trying to do is put them back into the narrative.
Yeah.
In their actual place. They've been written out of it a lot of the time. And it's just trying to give them their fair share of the limelight.
This is what I keep saying. And the narrative is predominantly men. This is something that's gone on for years. So I love that you're trying to do that, because I think it's definitely something I share in my career goal, wanting to thread women back into the historical narrative.
Mm. Yeah.
I really do.
I think girls these days, they need to hear it as well.
Yeah, it's empowering.
You know, we've all had it through school and that boys do certain things, girls do certain things, and girls need to know that they can do what they want to do.
Definitely.
Exactly. It's the only way we're going to get equality, if we actually make sure that they know that they are equal.
Yeah.
100%. Well, on that note then, Sharon, what has been the best moment of your career so far to inspire any woman listening right now?
My career so far was when I got to hold my book in my hand.
Aww.
There is nothing like actually holding a book. You look at it. Actually, when I first saw the cover, I was looking at the back of the cover. It's a photo of Rush Abbey. And they sent me a copy of the cover, and I'm looking at the photo thinking, I took that photo. My photo was on the cover. And then I'm like, it's your book, you don't know. But yeah, it's actually holding my book in my hands and looking through it and going, I wrote
it.
Yeah. I can't believe it. It's something nobody can take away from me now. I've written a book.
What an incredible achievement that is.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, okay, so we'll move on to our fun round now. And we're going to ask you a set of questions and just give your first immediate answer to. Doesn't require much thought. And where the best responses come from. Yeah. Right, are you ready?
Yep.
So who's your favourite historical figure in all of history?
Nicola de la Haye.
Okay.
The woman who held Lincoln Castle in 3 sieges.
Yeah, I can see why. What a boss.
Oh, love that.
Okay, flip it on its head. Who's your least favourite figure in all of history?
Oh, I don't think I have one. There's always people who either hate Richard III or hate Henry VII or whatever. I don't think I like Henry VIII. I don't think I would have liked to have met him. I don't think he was a very nice person. I don't think he was as nice as King John, to be honest.
No, we've had a lot of that. He's been quite popular. Yeah,
or unpopular.
Unpopular for that answer.
So I'm back to the nice questions. If you were to get in a car and go on a road trip with 3 people, dead or alive, any period of history, who would you have in your car?
I think he helped conquer England from the Vikings. Mm-hmm. And Agnes of Dunbar. Okay. I like Agnes of Dunbar. She's the one, she was besieged by the English.
Right.
And they were firing boulders at her castle and things like that. And she and her ladies would walk along the ramparts with the English. And then when the English were starving, these were the besiegers, they were starving, didn't have enough food. She was sending food out to them because she was managing to get food in by sea and they didn't know.
Oh my God, that's incredible.
And they eventually gave up and went home because she was just too good for them.
Well, that would be a very impressive car journey to listening to all of three of those women's achievements and how they all talked about their tactics and how they did it and what they did. And all having a little cackle at the end of getting one over the men. All right, final question then. If you go back in time for one day, where would you go?
I would have to go to the Tandon the day that fate, the prince was decided, the two princes in the tower. And find out who killed them or what happened to them, whether they disappeared, whether they were taken away or killed or whatever. It'd have to be that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting response.
Yeah, it's the biggest mystery around who killed the princes or were they killed. So that's what I'd have to do. I'd have to get to that moment just to see.
I like that. It's a very good note to lead this on.
Thank you so much for talking about today.
Yeah, thank you for coming on.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Oh, I'm so glad. So that was the wonderful Sharon Connolly with her book, The Ladies of Magna Carta. We won't have an episode next week as we're going to be taking a little hiatus, only for a month. So be ready for season 2 of Carki Malarki, where we have a very impressive list of guests lined up already. So thank you for joining us this season. I'm Olivia Smith.
And I'm Phoebe Stile. And this is Carki Malarki for the final time of the season. Signing off.